prices dropped further than most analysts expected and stayed longer than most analysts expected.
An updated revenue forecast bumps Alaska's deficit to more than $4 billion. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, March 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a small new commercial airline takes flight in the Bristol Bay region.
It's different than flying for a big airline because in that case, you don't really get to know your customers. You just fly a bunch of different people.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Salmon Project is all about the ways Alaskans' lives are supported by salmon. Their vision is for a future where Alaskans continue to be strong, nourished, and connected through Alaska's salmon resource. Learn more and be a part of the project, including the regular fund competitions. Our lives are salmon lives. Learn more at salmonproject.org. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Cuts to Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson's 425 Infantry Brigade Combat Team in Anchorage have officially been put on hold. Alaska's congressional delegation is celebrating today's announcement by the Army. In a combined release, Senator Dan Sullivan said, in part, the Army sent a strong message that America remains dedicated to our rebalance to the Pacific, Asia-Pacific, understands our leading role in the Arctic. Senator Lisa Murkowski said the reduction plan was short-sighted and the direction of world events would ultimately prove that. Both senators say they will work to make the hold permanent. In July, the Army announced plans to reduce the 425 by 2,600 soldiers. What do continued low oil prices mean for the state budget? It's not pretty. The Department of Revenue released a forecast today showing the state will bring in $800 million less in oil revenue this year and next than the department projected in the fall. APRN's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
Governor Bill Walker says the 17% drop in the oil revenue forecast reinforces the importance of his fiscal plan. The plan would draw money from permanent fund earnings to pay for state government. It also would introduce an income tax and raise other taxes, while cutting state spending.
It just underscores that the reason to make the shifts that we have, the plan that we have submitted, the new Sustainable Alaska Plan with the Permanent Fund Protection Act, shifts away from, it moves from the dependency on oil from a 90% down to 21%, and also underscores the urgency of doing it yet this year.
Walker adds that putting a fiscal plan in place this year would reduce the uncertainty that surrounds the state's future, as well as its ability to attract investors. The governor says he'll call a special session if the legislature doesn't pass any revenue measures this session. Revenue Commissioner Randall Hofbeck says the lowered forecast doesn't call into question the basic elements of Walker's fiscal plan.
The Permanent Fund Protection Act actually models a range of oil prices through a 25-year period. It assumes years of low oil price and years of high oil price. We had the staff go back and look to make sure that this oil price environment was within the parameters of the assumptions. It was. And so this would not impact the draw under the Permanent Fund Protection Act.
Soldotna Republican Senator Peter Michicki acknowledges the lower forecast will focus legislators' attention on bills that would raise revenue.
We have to have those other discussions about revenue. We've cut deeply. I mean, we've cut, over 2 years, we've cut about 17% in agency operations. This year alone, we've cut about $335 million. We've promised Alaskans that we were going to do that first. Now we have to have those other conversations.
So how did the state get the revenue forecast so wrong? Oil and gas industry expert Larry Persily doesn't blame the Department of Revenue.
It's no one's fault. It's not like Alaska got it wrong last fall. With the Revenue Department forecast, prices dropped further than most analysts expected and stayed longer than most analysts expected, though they have come up a little bit of late.
Persily says the governor is right to focus on moving state revenue away from volatile oil prices, but he says the state has a larger task as it tries to balance the budget.
We have to accept we're not the oil and gas state that we once thought we were, and we're never going to be the oil and gas state that we once were, because this isn't just prices, this is production. We're down 3/4 from the peak, and no one out there claims to have another Prudhoe Bay in their back pocket, so it is going to be an adjustment for Alaska.
Since both legislative houses passed their budgets in the past 2 weeks, they've started to focus on revenue-generating measures. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
The House Resources Committee on Saturday unveiled its version of an overhaul of the state's oil and gas tax credits. The new version removes one of the key changes proposed by Governor Bill Walker, raising the minimum tax paid by companies from 4% to 5%. The bill would trim the amount of tax credits paid to companies operating in the Cook Inlet. But Homer Republican Representative Paul Seaton says the new version would leave credits for companies operating on the North Slope unscathed.
You know, it's a huge, huge budgetary expense, and we're talking about we need to do budget cuts, and here I see almost no budget cuts.
But Rena Delbridge, an aide to Anchorage Republican Representative Mike Hawker, says the sponsors of the new version were concerned about making cuts to credits deeper. Delbridge worked on the changes.
The potential impacts to industry of immediate and dramatic changes in order to resolve a short-term, hopefully short-term or immediate-term budget problem could have fairly significant effects to our production in 3 years and in 5 years and in 10 years.
Governor Walker had proposed eliminating credits based on how much companies spend on drilling and exploration, but he would have allowed companies to continue to get tax credits based on their operating losses. The new version would scale back both types of credits for spending and for losses, but wouldn't eliminate either type. Ken Alper, State Tax Division Director, says the changes will affect the state's ability to balance its budget. He noted that eight other bills designed to raise revenue haven't passed the legislature. The bill also would establish a legislative working group that would make recommendations on broader changes to the tax system for companies in the Cook Inlet and the area south of the North Slope, known as Middle Earth. These recommendations would be due in time for the next legislative session. Government leaders and policymakers from circumpolar nations say they rely on the very best and latest science to make decisions about how to adapt to climate change and a rapidly warming Arctic. They converged in Fairbanks last week at the same time as one of the largest groups of Arctic scientists met to brainstorm on the next round of new research. KTOO's Matt Miller has the story.
The common theme expressed by those meeting in Fairbanks last week is that the Arctic is warming at an accelerating pace and climate change is inevitable and irreversible. What happens in the Arctic does not stay in the Arctic, and what happens in the mid-latitudes also affects the Arctic. Steve Guinness of the Fairbanks Native Association switched back and forth between Gwich'in and English as he welcomed 1,000 people from 30 countries during International Arctic Assembly Day. Guinness says climate change is affecting their way of life.
It's not a myth, like some people might claim. It's real. It really affects us up here, big time. Our fish, returning of our king salmon, is affected with the warming of the ocean water, among other things.
Lieutenant Governor Byron Malott says his eldest son, a lifelong commercial fisherman in Yakutat, is unable to reconcile current weather and ocean conditions with his early experiences.
It doesn't work anymore. He said, I feel disoriented in my own place. He said, all of those six senses that you brought to bear from your total work experience in this field really don't fit anymore.
Retired Coast Guard Admiral Robert Papp, U.S. State Department Special Representative for the Arctic, quoted a naval admiral who warned that there is no sharp boundary line between safety and fatal danger. There's no such thing as a blinking red light that warns ship captains before they head into bad weather.
So the analogy is there's no little red light that's going to go on and tell us when the Arctic has gone too far and is unrecoverable. It's going to be shaded. And I would say that if there was a little red light, that red light is probably going on right now. How long must we wait to take appropriate action to make sure that we preserve this environment?
U.S. Ambassador David Bolton and chair of the Arctic Council says Arctic nations have informally committed to not allowing commercial fishing in the ice-free waters of the Arctic Ocean, but a donut hole exists in the center of the ocean that is outside of any country's jurisdiction. Other non-Arctic countries may want to fish there soon.
At least from the point of view of the United States, what we are trying to do is get all of these players to agree to a binding regime that would enshrine the principles of this declaration. There should be no commercial fishing in this area until there is adequate science and until there is some framework for actually managing the fisheries in place. I don't know where this negotiation will take us. As we stand here today, this is an unanswered question.
Inuttik Holm Olsen is a University of Alaska Fairbanks graduate who now serves as Minister Plenipotentiary for Greenland representation at the Danish Embassy in Washington, D.C.
The policy-science interface quickly can become a sensitive one. It can either become too political if you have opposing agendas, which can be a hindrance to adopt policy in combating climate change. Or when we talk about the Arctic, there is a multitude of layers with a sizable presence of indigenous peoples that has to be incorporated in new ways of handling issues today.
Olsen says scientists and policymakers should not work in isolation. They need to build trust to engage each other in meaningful conversation. Arctic Science Summit Week on the University of Alaska Fairbanks campus last week featured meetings of the Arctic Council and the Model Arctic Council. It also included the Arctic Observing Summit, where scientists from around the world reported on their latest research and planned new projects for tracking the impacts of climate change. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Matt Miller.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Iditarod racers reflect on the fastest race in history, where not everything went as planned.
I was on the edge, but I came to play the game, and we poured it all out on the field.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Elder Mentor Program brings the wisdom of Alaskan elders into the classrooms and the communities across the state. Elders age 55 and older share their compassion, social support, and cultural values with the next generation. Earn a small stipend while supporting the educational staff and children. Alaska's Elder Mentors serve through the National Senior Corps Program. Mentor information at ruralcap.com. This message is sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
Alaska's shellfish farmers hope a new state mariculture initiative will help boost their businesses. But they warn it's not an easy industry to expand. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The state began allowing Alaskans to farm shellfish almost 30 years ago. The resulting farms raise scallops, mussels, and several species of clams. In recent years, oysters have gotten more attention. The state lists about 50 shellfish farms, though not all are active. Most are in southern southeast Alaska or Ketchumak Bay near Homer.
I think the market in Alaska has not been fully saturated, so I think there's plenty of room here.
Margot Rave is president of the Jackaloff Bay Oyster Company. She's also active in the Alaska Shellfish Growers Association. She says a lot of sales are within the state, but growers are looking farther away.
I think that some farmers are similar to salmon fishermen, finding that direct sales and online sales can bring a premium that make your farm viable.
The Walker-Mulott administration sees growth potential, too. The governor signed an administrative order in February setting up the Alaska Mariculture Task Force. It's charged with making recommendations for a long-term plan to advance the state's mariculture or ocean farming industry, which, by the way, does not include farming fish, which is against Alaska law. Barbara Blake, special assistant to the lieutenant governor, says the task force will play an important role in industry growth. She notes other shellfish farming states have that in common.
No state has been successful without first coming to the governor's office and having the governor lead an initiative that would kind of bring all of those resources together, pull all of those who are interested or who are already developing in that world to one table to help develop a framework that would be statewide, individual or even region-wide.
The idea came from Julie Decker, executive director of the Alaska Fisheries Development Foundation. She says the panel will learn from experienced farmers and outside industry experts.
And we think that we can apply mariculture in Alaska in a way that Alaskans want it to be applied and do something really positive that's good for our communities, the environment, and the economy as well.
Not that there aren't significant barriers to the business. Farmers say isolation, cold water temperatures, and business loan limitations have slowed development. But Decker says there's a new crop that could help build the industry. It's seaweed and kelp, which are in demand for food and beauty products.
It's a very short turnover, 6 to 9 months, and so you have more of a cash flow involved for farmers instead of waiting 3, 4 to 10 years or so for a crop, depending on the species.
Farmer Revay says it's worth trying.
We actually on our farm are experimenting with it right now, and I think that there's some potential there. There's a lot to be worked out in the processing side and the shipping side.
The new mariculture task force will involve shellfish farmers, industry associations, the university, and state officials. The cost of its work will come out of existing agency budgets, so it will require no new appropriations. Officials are in the process of choosing its 11 members. Their recommendations are due within about 2 years. In Juneau, I'm Ed Schoenfeld.
Anchorage-based Zeta Air made its first charter run with a Piper Cherokee Lance earlier this month, delivering people to Kakanak for the winter carnival. The flight was months and even years in the making. KDLG's Molly Dishner has more about the company flying to Nooshigak, Quijac, and Iliamna communities.
Owner Danielle Troll grew up in Anchorage, a second-generation Alaskan, but she didn't have any pilots in her family and didn't know much about aviation growing up.
I was about 17, and I remember where I was standing, and I just thought all of a sudden that I wanted to be a pilot. The question in my head was, can women be pilots?
The answer, she learned, is yes. But even now, it sometimes surprises her passengers, too.
Mostly my funny moments are people commenting on how I'm a woman pilot. One time, a man from New Spear said, "Holy cats, I get to fly with a beautiful woman." It was really funny.
Troll went to UAA for a degree in aviation technology. While she was there, she got a job with an existing airline servicing Bristol Bay called Kamikaze.
Joel Jacko was flying groceries to the Nooshigak area, and I started working for him shopping. And it was really cool timing because everything I learned at school, I could go and use. Everything stuck in my mind, and I got to apply what I learned, so that was really cool.
Between flying in the region and marrying into a family with roots in Dillingham, she got to know Bristol Bay a little better. And though Kamikaze changed hands and names a few times, and Troll worked elsewhere as well, the region stayed in her mind. So last fall, she bought what used to be Kamikaze, with an eye toward expanding the grocery delivery service to haul passengers.
My favorite part of my job is getting to know my customers. It's different than flying for a big airline because in that case, you don't really get to know your customers. You just fly a bunch of different people. But seeing a customer satisfied because, I brought their birthday cake in time for their daughter or, they just got a box of fresh produce or, they had a good flight or something, that's really rewarding. There's so many factors that can prevent that from happening that aren't really in my control, like weather. So it just makes it even more epic when it works out.
Every passenger, every person waiting on cargo knows just how frustrating weather can be. Aside from the mountains of paperwork necessary to get certified for passengers, Troll says weather has been her biggest challenge this winter. But even that is just part of the job, she says.
Like if everything's easy all the time, then you're not learning or improving. So every day I want to learn to be a better person and get better at what I do.
As for the name Zeta, it means little girl. There was an Italian Saint Zeta, a servant who set an example with her work ethic and perseverance and dedication to God. It's a story that's encouraged and inspired Troll and one she hopes to emulate. In Dillingham, I'm Molly Dishner.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Community Action on Toxics believes future generations have the right to clean water, clean air, and toxic-free food. Learn more by visiting akaction.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Community Action on Toxics.
It's as easy as 1, 2, 3. 1, file your 2016 PFD application today. 2, receive a confirmation of filing. And 3, sign electronically with your secure My Alaska account. Visit pfd.alaska.gov for more information. And remember, the deadline to apply is Thursday, March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Despite initial assessments otherwise, the Alaska State Fire Marshal will respond to the community of Emonic after a fire destroyed 5 commercial buildings over the weekend and caused at least $3 million in damage. Megan Peters is a spokesperson for the State Fire Marshal and the Alaska State Troopers. She says deputy fire marshals will likely arrive in Emonic tomorrow to investigate the cause of the fire, which is still unknown. At first, Peters says marshals chose not to respond because hazardous materials in the burned buildings would prevent them from conducting a thorough investigation. After further review, she says they decided the fire's significant impact on Emonic warrants a closer look after all.
These are large buildings in a community, and certainly it's a large dollar value that's involved in it with the loss. Just community impact is really a big thing, too.
While marshals investigate, Peter says she can't share what contaminants are in the buildings. The fire broke out on Saturday afternoon when smoke was seen billowing from the Quipuc Fisheries warehouse. The fire spread, destroying 5 buildings owned by Quipuc Fisheries and Yukon Marine Manufacturing, both subsidiaries of the Yukon Delta Fisheries Development Association. Troopers say the fire is still smoldering but contained. No one was harmed in the fire. Never in Iditarod history have as many teams finished the 1,000-mile race in under 9 days. But this year, 8 of the top 10 teams did just that. As KNOM's Emily Schwing reports, some of the mushers who crossed the finish line faced enormous adversity on their way to Nome. But without any major weather events, most of the mushing that took place was simply the fastest in the race's history.
It took exactly 9 days and 46 seconds for four-time champion Jeff King to complete this year's Iditarod. King has finished the race 26 times, but this year was certainly his fastest.
You know, I was wondering if it's going to be a 7-day race someday. Surely it's probably possible. And more power to anyone who can do it well.
When King first ran the race in 1981, it took him over 15 days. This year, he was running within a half hour of 2 fierce competitors, a Norwegian world champion, Ralph Johannesson, and Frenchman Nick Petit. For the second year in a row, King stood under the Burled Arch and claimed he wasn't racing as hard as he has in previous years.
I think the old Jeff King would have caught both those guys right in front of me, but it was too much work going over the Cape.
King says he simply didn't want to run behind his team for miles. Emotionally, this may have been one of the toughest races of King's career. 5 days in, a drunk snow machine driver plowed into his team while he was traveling down the Yukon River. One of his dogs was killed. 3 others were injured.
Quite frankly, the snow machine that hit us went by so fast, I don't think the dogs really realized what happened. It was more of a absolute blur from which only the ones who were impacted really realized what happened.
King decided to proceed with the race, in part to avoid the media frenzy that ensued following the incident.
It's real easy to imagine what and recognize what a bummer that night was on the trail, but the fact is, it could have been so much worse.
But he says the incident certainly changed his race.
Basically, that I had to leave 25% of my dogs, and I had less options. Performance-wise.
Even so, he managed to pull off a top 10 finish and a personal best. In fact, his race time is one that would have won the race 5 times in the last decade.
It was really hard this year. It was really hard.
Allie Zirkel also had a run-in with the same snow machine on the Yukon River. The experience had a serious impact on her, both emotionally and mentally. For the rest of the race, she tried to maintain her cool, but avoided media attention and kept to herself outside checkpoints.
Everyone goes through hard times in their life. They, you know, I guess I'd count on myself and my dogs.
But she managed to pull off a third place finish and her second best run time. 8 days, 18 hours, and 46 minutes.
And then Alaska, like, talked back, and every checkpoint I went through, people were so supportive, and I couldn't just be with myself. It turned out I was with everyone, and that's probably what a person ought to do anyway.
You're tired. You've been running all the way. The dogs are supposed to do the running.
After father-son duo Mitch and Dallas Evie finished in the top two positions this year, they joked with each other about how fast they had to move to get to know him.
Six got here faster than any dogs ever have.
Yeah. You got the record?
Yeah.
Again?
I mean, it was 8:11.
This year, Dallas Evie beat the race record. It's one he set himself. And he beat it by 2 hours, completing the 1,000-mile journey in 8 days, 11 hours, and 22 minutes. Mitch Seavey also achieved a new personal best time.
Yeah, I thought we were going to be, like, within half an hour for it.
It seems that most of the teams, even in the top 20, were able to surge toward Nome. After Brent Sass's team refused to leave the White Mountain checkpoint, he was forced to rest his dogs for nearly a full day.
I mean, I knew I was on the edge, but I came to play the game. And, you know, we poured it all out on the field and gave it all we could and came up a little short. But, I mean,
even with the extra rest, his runtime would have put him in third place 3 years ago. This year's race trail was a hard-packed combination of ice and snow and, in places, bare dirt. When he pulled across the finish line in eighth place, Norwegian Ralph Johannesson seemed surprised at the lack of severe weather and extreme cold.
No problem, and we had sunshine mostly every day. So, no wind, and no snow, and it's a good race.
Without the challenges Mother Nature usually throws at the race, mushers could simply do what they do best, drive dog teams. A combination of high-quality dog care, mental toughness, and resiliency brought many of them to Nome in record time. And if they watched closely, spectators got a rare glimpse into the technical skills and savvy strategizing that plays out during a long-distance sled dog race. At the end of the Iditarod Trail, I'm Emily Schwing in Nome.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman, Matt Miller and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Molly Dishner in Dillingham, and Laura Craigle and Emily Schwing in Nome. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
And by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Alaska's tobacco quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.